Welcome, everybody. This is the sixth lecture for the Mises Academy class, Anatomy of the Fed. Today is July 30th, 2012. This is the second time we've offered this course. And tonight we're going to be talking about conventional Fed operations. So just to make sure everyone understands this distinction, this week, which is lecture six, I'm going to be talking about how the Fed normally goes about buying assets or selling assets and thereby adjusting the total amount of reserves, and then explaining how that influences interest rates and economic growth and price inflation, all that kind of stuff. Next week, lecture seven is going to be on unconventional Fed operations. So there, we're going to talk more specifically about the so-called extraordinary measures in which the Fed and the ECB have engaged since the 2008 crisis really hit. Right, so just to say in other words, the stuff we're going to be talking about tonight is standard textbook theory about how central banks operate that we could have given in the year 2005, and I would have said mostly the same stuff, whereas lecture 7 stuff is going to all be fairly new. I'm going to be talking about, you know, QE1, QE2, Operation Twist, that kind of stuff. Okay, so as you can see from the outline here, we got a lot of material to cover. Okay, so first of all, I just want to show you two important monetary aggregates. So what do I mean by that term? It's a fancy term just meaning different ways of measuring the total, what many people would call money supply. So since a lot of you taking this class are pretty advanced and are purists and really want to know high-powered stuff, let me just draw a little distinction here. So the term money supply versus stock of money. All right, so let me just take a minute or two and explain this distinction. I will try to always use terms like the stock of money or the total quantity of money rather than saying the money supply. And the reason for that is somewhat pedagogical, but it's because when we teach standard micro, we're usually pretty anal about telling people don't get things mixed up here, don't confuse a change in the quantity supplied with a change in supply itself, or don't confuse a change in the demand curve with a movement along the demand curve, right? So there's that distinction. If you have taken a microeconomics class, or if you took something from me, the principles of economics class that I offer on the Mises Academy, chances are you've had that distinction hammered into your head. Again, the distinction being moving along a supply or a demand curve versus moving the entire curve itself left or right. So because of that distinction, if you're going to be careful about that, technically then when you're talking about money, if what you mean is an increase in the number of dollar bills, well, that's not an increase in the supply of money, because the supply of money would mean a supply curve showing at various possible prices of money what's the quantity supplied. And so if what you're trying to say is the number of dollar bills went from $1 trillion in this year to $2 trillion so many years later, strictly speaking, you shouldn't call that an increase in the supply. You should call that an increase in the quantity. Just like if the amount of apples were 1,000 bushels last year and this year it's 1,100 bushels, if you said, oh, the supply of apples went up, then probably you're going to lose points on an introductory micro exam because the teacher's going to say, no, the supply of apples didn't go up. You don't know if the supply of apples went up. There could be a drought. The supply could have gone down, But if the demand went way up too, then in equilibrium, the quantity supplied is higher than it was before, even though the supply went down, right? So because of those sorts of pedantic, you know, quibbling, that's why technically, if all you mean is the total amount of dollars went up, then you should refer to that as an increase in the quantity or the stock of money. But for whatever reason, historically, economists often say, oh yeah, the money supply went up, when they actually mean what I just talked about. All right, so if you've never taken a Principles of Economics class and you don't know what I'm talking about, don't worry about it. It's not a big deal. I'm just pointing out this little subtlety for people who have taken a lot of economics classes, if they're wondering why it seems like I always use these odd phrases instead of saying the more familiar increase in the money supply. Okay, so back to this slide now, monetary aggregates. So So the term aggregate, of course, here is being used as a noun. We're saying there's different ways to denote the aggregate amount of money, so there's different types of monetary aggregates we might choose to use as economists, all right? So make sure you understand that, that there's no single definition of the quantity of money. So if somebody says, hey, speaking colloquially, if I say, hey, what's the money supply this year and how much has it gone up since 2006? There's no crisp answer to give to that question because you'd have to say, well, what do you mean by the total amount of money? That there's various ways of defining that. So here what I'm showing in this chart is two different ways you could talk about it. And also, for those who want to see more, I have a Mises.org article. I don't remember if we've linked it from the syllabus, so let me just go ahead and say it officially. It's called Lost in a Maze of Aggregates, I think. All right, so it's at Mises.org. So if you just go to Google and say Robert Murphy, Lost in a Maze of Aggregates, especially if you hone it to be restricted to Mises.org, for sure you're going to find it. Or you can go to my archives if you know how to find that on Mises.org and see it there. So there I go through and define monetary base M1, M2, M3, and then what's called the Austrian money supply. And so if you really care about those fine distinctions, I spell them all out there. For our purposes right now, let me just focus on two of the conventional measures. So the first one is what's called the monetary base. So in this chart, it's the blue line. So what that includes is the total amount of actual currency, the green pieces of paper that have Federal Reserve note printed on it and a picture of a dead U.S. president, and also bank reserves on deposit with the Fed. And banks' holdings of those pieces of paper. Okay, so this is what's called high-powered money in some contexts. So in particular, what the monetary base does not include is unbacked demand deposits at commercial banks. All right, so when you go and, so if you have $1,000 in cash in your wallet, that's part of the monetary base. But then if you deposit that in a bank, and so now what you have is $1,000 in your checking account balance, and then the bank lends out 900 of it to somebody else, then as far as you're concerned, of your $1,000 in money that you think you have in your head, only 100 of it is actually now part of the monetary base. All right, so that 900 didn't disappear because it's going to be caught whatever happened to it. You know, if the $900 is sitting in somebody else's wallet, it's going to be picked up there. But the point is commercial bank lending activity can affect the monetary base. So the Fed pretty much directly controls the monetary base, because the Fed can control how much currency exists and the reserves that commercial banks have with the Fed. where it, so the public in its decisions to deposit money or withdraw money from commercial banks won't affect the monetary base. So that's why a lot of economists, when they're trying to gauge how tight or loose is the Fed behaving or is the Fed's policies, they would look at the monetary base because they're saying that's the thing the Fed can directly control. Whereas things like M1, M2 involve components over which the public has some influence. And so you could argue, well, you know, if one of those things starts going up or down, that doesn't reflect a change in Fed policy. It could just reflect a change in the public's attitudes or behavior. Whereas if the monetary base goes up, then clearly the Fed consciously chose to increase the amount of reserves. Okay, so that's the monetary base. And you can see from this chart that it absolutely explodes starting in 2008, that it has more than tripled since then. So it's the monetary, when you see charts showing what Ben Bernanke has done since the crisis, and there are just these humongous increases, probably you're looking at a chart of the monetary base. And so that goes hand in hand with the Fed having expanded its balance sheet. So we'll get into this a little bit more in tonight's lecture, but I'm just saying that what this chart is showing you is how much both actual currency and commercial banks' deposits with the Fed itself, which are known as reserves or are a component of reserves, have gone up. Now, another measure is M1. And M1 is, one way to think about it is to say it's a very narrow definition of money that is held by the public. And I'm speaking loosely here. If you go to my article, you can see the crisp, more exact definitions. But M1, loosely speaking, consists of currency that the public is holding plus demand deposits in the public's possession. All right, so if you're an individual and you've got $400 in actual cash, you know, $100 bills, $20 bills, $5 bills in your wallet and in your piggy bank on your countertop, and you've got $500 in your checking account balance, regardless of the reserve ratio, so in other words, regardless of how much currency or reserves the commercial bank has backing up your 500, doesn't matter. That right there, those two things count as $900 going into M1, because you've got, what did I say, 400 in actual currency and 500, you think, on deposit with your commercial bank. So that's 900 right there, that's part of M1, and you would do that for every other household, and then the grand total would be total amount of M1. So we'll see in a minute, the public can affect M1 by its behavior because of the funky thing with fractional reserve banking. But again, the public cannot affect the monetary base. So before we leave this slide, let me just point out one thing, because it is relevant to the lessons people were drawing from the Great Depression and what Fed policy should be right now. Notice that M1, which is the red line on this chart, it also, since 2008, has gone way up. Proportionally, it hasn't gone up as much as the monetary base, but it certainly has gone up a lot. So it went up from, I'm just eyeballing the chart here, it went up from around, I don't know, 1350 or so 1.35 trillion up to now it's about, I don't know, 2300, so 2.3 trillion. So that's a pretty big increase, especially when you see historically that M1 does not steadily rise. That in fact, as you can see from, there were large stretches here from about, what is that, like the mid-90s, for several years there where M1 actually dipped down a little bit. And then also in the mid-2000s, there was a stretch there where M1 for a few years was flat. And then now it's skyrocketed. Okay, so keep that in mind when I explain to you what happened during the Great Depression and the policy lessons that Milton Friedman and other modern monetarists draw from that. And so you'll see why it's odd that they're saying Bernanke is repeating the same mistakes as the Great Depression. Okay, so the money stock. For Misesians, when you ask what's the quantity of money, or if you're speaking colloquially and say what's the money supply, usually what they mean is that it's the combination of what Mises would call money in the narrower sense, as well as money substitutes. So here, money in the narrower sense means the actual good that is the commonly accepted medium of exchange. So back when gold or silver were the commodity money, it meant actual gold or silver. All right, so let's just speak for a minute as if we have an economy where gold is the money. So money in the narrower sense would, of course, be gold. And people would take hunks of the yellow metal and go to a private mint, and they would hammer it into coins. And so that would clearly be the money. There would be nothing that was more money than that. So that would be as deep as you could go. That would be as further down or as far down as you could drill, so to speak. There'd be nothing below that. That was bedrock. That's money in this community. But now, if you take that and you go and you deposit it at a commercial bank and they give you banknotes that say, for example, the bearer of this note can go to any branch of Citibank and turn it in and instantly get 1 ounce coin of gold, well, now that piece of paper is what Mises would call a money substitute, because it's an airtight and immediate claim on money. So the immediate claim means that's part of what's printed on it. It's payable upon demand. And the fact of it being airtight means if in practice the community has no doubt that these banknotes will be honored. And no doubt meaning in terms of day-to-day worrying about it, that people, like merchants, accept them at par. Obviously everybody knows in principle the bank might default. But meaning if in practice merchants say, nah, I've never had a problem with that bank in my practice, and in terms of me talking to the other merchants, I've never heard of anybody being turned away from Citibank when someone hands over a Citibank banknote that says the bearer of this gets one gold ounce. So if you're a merchant selling stuff and you price it at 8 gold ounces, and someone approaches the counter and pays you with 8 gold coins, you clearly would take those. But if someone gives you 8 pieces of paper that are all each individually banknotes issued by Citibank that say 1 gold ounce each, if you accept those at par, so you don't distinguish between actual coins versus notes issued by Citibank, well, then Mises would say those things issued by Citibank are money substitutes because they perform all of the services of money proper, or money in the narrower sense. Because the reason you're walking around with gold coins, if you're holding them as money and not because you view them as jewelry, is that they're a medium of exchange, that you know or you believe you can trade them for goods and services in the future, and so that's what constitutes your demand to hold them now in your cash balances. But that's exactly what money substitutes do for you if they are generally accepted in the community. So a 1 ounce note issued by Citibank is just as useful to you as an individual as a metal coin that's literally made out of gold and that's stamped 1 ounce by a reputable mint. Because you can go around the community and command the same amount of goods and services with either of those things. And so in that sense, they're both money. They do whatever money does. And so Mises calls it a money substitute. Now he distinguishes it. That's why he has the subdivision of saying money in the narrower sense and money in the broader sense. But when Mises talks about the quantity of money increasing, he usually would mean money in the broader sense, meaning including both the actual money and also money substitutes. Okay, so then the Austrian money supply, which is a concept that Murray Rothbard started to develop, and then Joe Salerno worked on it too, and then, you know, now Salerno is like the world's expert on the Austrian money supply. It doesn't overlap perfectly with any of the more conventional aggregates, so it's not exactly what the monetary base, because the monetary base doesn't include commercial demand deposits, but it also doesn't overlap exactly with M1 and M2. That it's, I think the Austrian money supply has things in it that M1 doesn't have, but M2 has stuff in it that Salerno doesn't think should be part of the actual legitimate money supply. Okay, so it is a distinct definition. And a lot of Austrians believe that when you're asking, hey, what has Bernanke done with the quantity of money since the crisis began, they would say that's the graph to look at. That's the one that should move more closely with various price aggregates and things like that. Okay? And again, if you are curious, go look at my article, Lost in a Maze of Aggregates, to see these different definitions. The crucial thing, I said it in reference to the earlier slide, I'll say it again here, that unbacked demand deposits are part of the money stock. So they're part of M1, M2, M3. They're part of the Austrian money supply. And in Misesian terminology, they do constitute money substitutes. Okay, so go back, because again, it's easier to think in terms of gold coins to keep the stuff distinct. A community with gold coins, if they have fractional reserve banking, then the quantity of money, if we mean money in the broader sense, which includes those banknotes issued by Citibank and other commercial banks, the quantity of money can expand not merely if miners bring more gold to the surface. I mean, that's obvious, right? If miners bring in an extra 1,000 pounds of gold and people use some of it to make jewelry and then take a bunch of it and go to the mints and they crank out, stamp out more coins, and now there's more gold coins circulating in the community, well, clearly the quantity of money has gone up. And other things equal, we would expect prices quoted in gold ounces to be higher than they otherwise would have been. So either the prices will literally go up, or even if they go down, because maybe total production of real goods and services has gone up, the fall in prices would be smaller than otherwise would have been the case. So still, compared to what would have happened, that increase in gold mining and then the production of more coins makes prices higher than they otherwise would have been. Okay, but that's obvious, but what's also true, and this is what's so important, and one of the things that's crucial to understand about fractional reserve banking, is that the commercial banks can also increase the total quantity of money, even if the amount of gold hasn't changed. So what happens there is, if let's say initially you had 100% reserves, so somebody takes 10 gold coins, deposits them with Citibank, Citibank puts them in the vault and then gives you 10 pieces of paper that say the bearer of this gets one gold coin upon demand, that doesn't change money in the broader sense, right? All it's done is change the composition of the money stock held by the public. But now, if Citibank begins to engage in fractional reserve banking, and they take nine of those gold coins and lend them out to other people, or if they issue 9 more pieces of paper that are using that same stockpile of coins in the vault as the reserves, so either way now, if they lend the coins out directly, now people in the community are holding 9 more gold coins than they were before, so that's an increase. Or if they just issue 10 more banknotes with those same ones serving as reserves, then you know, you can see the total quantity of money held by the community has gone up, even though there's the same amount of physical gold. Okay, so I anticipated some of that, what I just said in this slide, what I intended to say for this slide marked reserves. So again, if you have 100% reserve banking, the public cannot influence the size of the money stock, just its composition. Let me just spell one thing out in case you're a little bit confused. Because what you do is you try to avoid double counting. And that's what I touch on in this second bullet point here. So if you initially have, so let's see if I can, so if you got a guy and he initially has 5 gold coins, and then here's the bank. If he puts that in the vault, and then the bank gives the guy 5 pieces of paper that are for 1 gold coin each, we're going to say that doesn't affect the total quantity of money, because you don't count. So you might be thinking, well, wait a minute, but there's still the same number of gold coins total, and now there's 5 more banknotes floating around, even with 100% reserves. So wouldn't the total number of gold coins be the same number, and now you're adding 5 more banknotes? So shouldn't the quantity of money have gone up by 5 ounces, even with 100% reserves? And the answer is no, because the way you count it, when we say that we're measuring the total quantity of money proper plus substitutes, we don't double count. So if you can do it either way. You can either say we're only counting these money substitutes if they're unbacked, or you can say we don't count gold coins that are in the vault serving as reserves. So you can do it one way or the other, but you got to just do it and be consistent, so that if all that's happening is the public is changing its composition, so that this guy right here, he started out with 5 ounces of money, 5 gold ounces of money. Whether he's holding 5 coins or whether he's holding 5 notes entitling him upon demand to getting 5 gold ounce coins, either way, he's only got 5 ounces of money on him. And that's the number that goes into the aggregate, whether you're talking about M1 or M2 or even the Austrian money supply. All right? So under 100% reserves, that number can't change. Whatever the total amount of gold coins is at time one, I don't care what the public does, whether they're holding them all in their pockets or whether they put them all on deposit with the bank and are all walking around with notes. At time two, the total quantity of money is still going to be the same number of ounces, assuming the miners haven't brought more ounces into the community. But if there's only a fractional reserve requirement, now things are different, because now if the public puts gold coins into the vaults, the banks can issue more notes on top of that. And so the public ends up getting more notes out than they had to put in gold coins. And so the total goes up, even though you're still doing the rule about not doing double counting. Okay, one thing to note is there are some weird outcomes that also can happen when the banks are not fully loaned up. And I'll talk about that in a second, but let me just make sure you know what do I mean by this term, fully loaned up. I mean that they issue as many loans as fractional reserve law allows. Okay, so if you have, if the government's regulation is there's a 10% reserve requirement, meaning for all the outstanding demand deposits that this bank's customers have total, you have to have 10% of that in the vault as reserves. Well, if the bank's fully loaned up, that means all they've got is 10% in reserve. Whereas if they had more than that, they would be less than fully loaned up. Okay, so another way of saying it is, if a bank has more reserves than it needs to satisfy the legal requirement, it is less than fully loaned up. Whereas if a bank has just as much reserves in the vault as the law says you have to have because of your outstanding demand deposits that your customers hold, well, now you're fully loaned up. So theoretically, you would normally expect banks to be fully loaned up. Because remember, the whole point is they make more interest income the larger the volume of loans they issue. And we argued that perhaps the true motivation for central banking was that the banks, the big banks, benefit from this cartel so they can all inflate in unison and the natural market reactions to fractional reserve banking get weakened. So normally then, if what we're arguing is that the commercial banks benefit from having the Fed make it easier to inflate, normally you would think the banks would go right up to what the law allows. And as we'll see in a minute, that is historically basically what happened. It has not happened since the 2008 crisis, and that explains a lot of the weird things that have gone on since then. Let me touch on one point before moving forward. So I think the strategy for you, if you're still working through these concepts and these definitions and you're trying to think things through, and I do this myself, if I'm thinking about a problem with money and banking and I'm having trouble, first what I do is picture a commodity money economy where they're using literal gold coins, and that's the base commodity money. And then I work from there. I solve the problem in that world, and then I say, okay, now suppose the money is fiat money. And then I switch to that because it's easier to think of it in terms of gold. So everything I just said is true with a fiat money economy. But there, what is money in the narrower sense? It's the fiat money. So in the U.S., it's the U.S. dollar, but more specifically, the Federal Reserve notes, the pieces of paper, the currency, and commercial banks' deposits with the Fed, entitling them to those Federal Reserve notes. So again, let me just back this up a bit. So it's a little bit hard to picture, perhaps, but what you need to realize is there is both an economic and a legal difference between a $100 bill in your wallet, a green piece of paper with Benjamin Franklin's picture on it, versus Citibank telling you you have $100 in your checking account. That both in terms of Austrian economics and in terms of U.S. law, the $100 bill in your wallet is more money than the $100 that Citibank says that it owes you, basically. Right? What you have with Citibank is actually you just have a claim on a $100 bill, whereas when you're holding the actual $100 bill, that's it. That's what the money is. And it's just like in a gold community, an economy that uses gold, the gold coins aren't claims on anything. And maybe I should spend a minute talking about that, because that's something that a lot of people get mixed up about. All right, so in Austrian theory, money is the universally accepted medium of exchange. It is not a claim. Money is not debt, per se. All right, if you sell your labor to somebody, he gives you a gold coin for it, you don't have a claim on the rest of the community. It's not that there's some imaginary ledger and you're down your labor and now the community owes you a bunch of goods and services to make up for it, and you're sort of caught in this intermediate halfway house with this gold coin that is kind of like your claim ticket to get the real stuff. That's not really a good way to think about it, and you're going to get screwed up if you think about it like that. All right, so it's wrong, literally, right? That's just not what money is. There is no claim that you have on the rest of the community, and it's not even useful metaphorically. Mises talks about that in the theory of money and credit, that's a lot of socialist theorists pictured money being like that under socialism, that it would be you would go to the factory and work for a certain amount and you get paid in these tickets that would then mean when you go to the store, you have a claim on society's total output based on how much you worked or whatever, based on how big your family is and how much the central planners thought you should get out of the total crop that year. So Mises is saying that's not what money is in a market economy, and it's a very superficial understanding, and you don't get very far in terms of monetary theory if that's from the beginning how you're thinking of it. You're like, oh, yeah, basically money is just a claim on goods and services. Don't think like that because it isn't. And you're going to, like I say, you're not going to get very far in terms of analyzing problems in monetary theory. So by the same token then, fiat money is not a claim on anything. And the fiat money itself is not debt. And this is something that there's this weird sense in which there's a lot of government debt associated with fiat money. And maybe later in the lecture or in the Q&A, if somebody wants to ask me about that, we can talk about it. And so there is a weird sense in a fractional reserve fiat money system in which our money is closely related with government debt. But strictly speaking, the Federal Reserve note, it's not really debt because you don't have a claim on anything. You can't go to the government or the Fed and say, here's a $100 bill I have, give me something. They'll say, okay, here's 520s. See what I mean? So they're not obligated to give you anything. Whereas originally, back under the gold standard, it was a liability. It was a claim. It was a money substitute where gold was really the money. And the dollar notes that the Fed issued, or that the Treasury did before the Fed, they were actually claims on gold. And so it's a weird thing that has happened now that they've severed that link, where now the dollar itself, even though it's a Federal Reserve note, has become the base money. Okay. So this notion of excess reserves, what does that mean? And this, of course, has been really important to understand since the 2008 crisis hit. So excess reserves means, or if a single commercial bank has excess reserves, that means the bank is not fully loaned up. It means that the bank has more in reserves than it needs to satisfy the legal requirement that the Federal Reserve System has in place. So let me just speak in round numbers. If you're Citibank and your customers collectively have $1 trillion in deposit with you, so every single of your customers, if you said how much do they think they have on deposit with you in their checking account balances, so this guy over here has $680, that guy over there has $2,000, this big corporate client over here has $240,000, and so on. You add up all those numbers, and all of your clients collectively think they have on deposit with Citibank $1 trillion. And now the Fed says to Citibank, we have a reserve requirement. You have to have 10% reserves. Now, incidentally, it's not that simple in practice. If you go and look at the regulations, it's not a single percentage that applies across the board. It's actually, it depends on how big a bank it is, and there's one percentage for the first X amount of reserves or deposits, and then there's a different percentage for ones above that, right? But just loosely speaking, for our purposes, suppose it's just 10%, a flat 10% for everybody, for any amount of deposits. Because that makes the math easier. All right, so the Fed says to Citibank and every other bank, you need to have 10% reserves. So what that means for Citibank is, okay, our customers collectively have $1 trillion in demand deposits with us. They think they can write checks on that. They think they can swipe their debit card. They can show up and say, I want to withdraw $200, blah, blah, blah. That number is $1 trillion. We have a 10% reserve requirement, so that means we need in reserves $100 billion. Now, in what form can those reserves consist? It can either be actual currency in our vaults, or it can also be satisfied if we, Citibank, ourselves have a checking account with the Federal Reserve. And what it would technically be would be with the Federal Reserve banks in the various districts. Then that also satisfies the reserve requirement. So let's say we have $70 billion in currency in our vaults, and we have $30 billion on deposit with the Fed. So that's 70 plus 30, that's $100 billion. So we're fully loaned up. We've just satisfied our reserve requirement. Because of the $1 trillion in outstanding deposits our customers have with us, we've got $100 billion in reserves. $70 billion in actual currency that are in Citibank vaults. So if people show up and say, I want some of my money, we just open the vault and there's the cash to give to them. And we have another $30 billion on deposit with the Fed. Now notice that $30 billion on deposit with the Fed, that might not correspond to actual green pieces of paper. That might just literally be a ledger entry on the Fed's books, but legally that's as good as currency, both in terms of the statutory requirements, but also economically, because the Fed can just have that money printed up. If there's a run on Citibank and people want to draw out currency and they go through all the $70 billion they had in their vault and people still want to take out more currency, Citibank is fine drawing down the $30 billion on deposit with the Fed. They don't need to worry that, oh my gosh, that $30 billion doesn't really exist. It's just a ledger entry on the Fed's books saying they owe us $30 billion if we want it. No, that money is effectively as good as having the green pieces of paper because the government just print that up. The Fed can say to the Bureau of Printing and Engraving, oh, Citibank wants to withdraw $10 billion of its $30 billion that we're saying we owe it. So fire up $10 billion in currency and hand it over to them. All right, so that's what reserve requirements are. So now go back to that same scenario. Citibank has $1 trillion in demand deposits that its customers hold with it. And let's suppose it has $101 billion in total reserves. It has $71 billion in currency in the vaults, and $30 billion on deposit with the Fed, so $101 billion total in reserves. In this scenario, with a 10% reserve requirement, Citibank would actually have $1 billion in excess reserves because it's got $1 billion in reserves over and above the legal minimum that it needs to satisfy its reserve requirements. Okay, so that's what excess reserves are, saying reserves that a bank has over and above the legal minimum it needs. Okay, so with all that in mind, you can see that typically, so on this chart, the blue line is excess reserves. And the way to read these Fred charts, this is Fred, the economic data site put out by the St. Louis Federal Reserve. The way to read these things is the top always gives you what the various lines are, so you know, oh, there's excess reserves of depository institutions, and then this thing shows you how Fred, like the label that Fred gives to this variable. And so if you want to go look it up yourself, you can just type that excresns. The ns means not seasonally adjusted. And you know, obviously it's excess reserves, not seasonally adjusted. And then the other one is the Board of Governors total reserves adjusted for change reserve requirements. And that's the TRARR is how Fred denotes that in its eternal graphing and such. And then down here, you can see the legend shows you that the excess reserves are the blue line and the total reserves are the red line. So you can see historically, excess reserves tend to be very close to zero. In fact, they look like they're zero the whole time. The only time you really see a blip is right there. And what that is, it's the, I'm pretty sure that's the Y2K run up and then draw down. The only reason I'm hesitating is because it looks like it's a little bit too far to the right, given the scale of the graph, but I'm pretty sure that's what that's got to be. All right, that the, 9/11? Yeah, it could be 9/11 too. Yeah, that would probably, that seems like it's, that would make more sense with the scale. Okay. It's hard to see at this level because stuff since 2008 dwarfed it. You can't see it. But there was a run up both before Y2K and then also after the 9/11 attacks. And so that's, you would see little blips from that, which at the time were big blips, but now they seem like nothing compared to obviously what's happened since then. So another way of putting it is if we had just graphed this graph up until 2007, then the Y2K and the 9/11 stuff would look like major moves by the Fed, but now they seem like child's play compared to what Bernanke's done since 2008. Okay, but anyway, what's the point? The point is typically you can see even though total reserves here have drifted up and then down and so forth, the blue line stays remarkably close to zero. So that's what it would look like if you just think it through. It's hard sometimes to imagine what these curves would look like, but just think about it. Over time, if the Fed is increasing the total amount of reserves in the system, both by an increase in green pieces of paper held by Americans and by an increase in the quantity of reserves that commercial banks hold with the Fed, over time, total reserves go up. But as long as commercial banks continue to expand the amount of loans they make so that the total amount of deposits held by their customers also rises, then if they're always fully loaned up or if they quickly become fully loaned up after an injection of new reserves, then the excess reserves would move back towards zero. All right, so one way of putting it is, suppose you're originally fully loaned up, the total reserves are whatever they are, excess reserves are basically zero. Now the Fed comes in, it buys some assets, and it increases total reserves. Well, in that first moment after the action, excess reserves would go up by the same amount. Both total and excess would both go up the same amount. But then, now that the commercial banks are, oh, we're sitting on extra reserves, if we want to, we can make more loans. Normally, historically, they would do that. They would push down the interest rate a little bit in order to move more of those loans out. They'd expand their portfolio, and they'd be earning more interest income as long as the default rates weren't out of hand, and they were what they thought they would be. So then the total reserves would still stay at that higher, new higher plateau, but the excess reserves would go back towards zero. And you can see historically that's what tended to happen, except since 2008, what happened? Total reserves have skyrocketed. They fell back a little bit, went way up, and then fell back a little bit more. But excess reserves have moved almost perfectly in tandem. And so, you know, what does that mean? What it means is the Fed has come in, bought a ton of assets, greatly expanded the amount of total reserves in the system, but the commercial banks have not increased their lending. They have just allowed those excess reserves to pile up and are not increasing the volume of loans they give in response. And so that's one reason that the quant measures like M1 and M2 have not grown nearly as much as the monetary base has grown. Because a lot of what happened is the Fed floods the system with more reserves, but the commercial banks don't lend out more in response. Okay, how can the public change reserves? The quick answer is they can, by their decisions to deposit or withdraw funds from the banking sector. So the, from an individual household's point of view, you're not changing the quantity of money that you hold, money in the broader sense, by depositing money with a commercial bank or by withdrawing it. Right, if you have $1,000 in currency and you decide to put $600 of it in Citibank, how much money do you have now? Money in the broader sense? Well, now you still have $1,000. Now instead of having $1,000 in currency, you've got $400 in currency and $600 in a demand deposit with Citibank. But as we'll see, if everybody initially started out with $1,000 in currency and then put 60% of it on deposit with the commercial banks, that would allow for a big increase in the total quantity of money because of fractional reserve banking. Okay, so let's walk through the, all these examples that I'm calling here Rothbard's examples. They come from Chapter 10 of The Mystery of Banking, the PDF of which is linked from your syllabus. So I'm going to, I've been trying to spell this stuff out for you as we move along in today's lecture, but truly, to fully understand conventional Fed operations, you need to read Rothbard's Chapter 10. That ideally you should have read it first and now hearing my commentary, or if you didn't read it already, okay, go read it, and then if you have time, hopefully listen to this lecture again, because I couldn't just walk through it from scratch in the time we have, and so that's why I'm just assuming you already read it, and I'm just trying to supplement it. So all, like I say, all these examples come from Rothbard's Chapter 10, and I'm not going over everything he did there. I'm just going to go over a select few so that really what I want to make sure is that you understand Rothbard's notation, that I want to make sure I teach you guys how you can read his diagrams so that his explanations then make sense to you. Okay, so what we're doing in this first example, this is, hang on a second, let me just jump ahead. Okay, this first one here, I believe, is figure 10.1. I truncated it or I cropped it to make it big enough on the slide so you could read it, but I think this is figure 10.1. So what he's talking about here is he's walking through an example where the public is going to increase its demand to hold actual currency. So initially, we're in an initial equilibrium, and that's what we're going to go over first in this slide right here. That's called A, Rothbard's example. And then we're going to advance to the next slide that's going to show what happens if the public decides they want to reduce their deposits in the commercial banks and they want to increase the amount of cash that they're literally holding in their purses and wallets. And we'll talk later in a few minutes about why would the public do that, but the point is let's just work through what happens in a fractional reserve system if the public decides to do that. Okay, so in this example, there is a, it's not listed on the actual diagram, but there is a 20% reserve requirement. So just keep that in mind that in this system, Rothbard is assuming there's a 20% reserve requirement. And you can see that now here. Okay, so what is this? There's two, so don't get confused. There's two separate balance sheets going on here. So let me break them up like this way. All right, so there's this one up here, and then there's this one down here. So that's one thing that could be confusing to you. So on top, we have all commercial banks, and then on this bottom half, Rothbard's just looking at the central bank. So focus up here at first. So we're looking at all the commercial banks. So the point is, he's not looking just at Citibank. He's taking all the commercial banks and lumping them together and looking at all their assets and all their equity and liabilities. Okay. So initially what happens? Initially Rothbard says the public has on deposit with the commercial banks $50 billion in demand deposits. So that's listed on the right-hand side of the balance sheet as a liability. So that's why it's there. Now, these are not full balance sheets. And again, this is the trade-off. Rothbard didn't want to overwhelm you guys with a bunch of detail, but then he also kind of makes it hard if you're a little bit lost, because these aren't real balance sheets. Whereas in my lecture that I gave, it was either in week two or three, I think week two, where I went over the mechanics of fractional reserve banking and we were working with different balance sheets and going through them one step at a time. There, even though they were very simple ones, you know, they were real hypothetical and simplistic, I was showing you actual balance sheets. Here, these are just excerpts because, for example, there's no equity. And this, you know, this thing, you said, what's the equity? There isn't any. And so that's kind of odd. In real life, you would expect the commercial banks would have some equity, but they don't here. So, and the reason for that is Rothbard just trying to give you the bare minimum amount of numbers so you can see how things change. So, again, the customers of all the commercial banks collectively have $50 billion on deposit with them. So from the commercial bank's point of view, on their balance sheet, those things show up as a liability. All right, and that's why it's on the right-hand side. And so total liabilities is $50 billion. Now on the asset side, what do they have? They also have assets of $50 billion. So the two add up to each other. $10 billion of it are reserves. $40 billion are IOUs. So that 40 plus 10 equals 50. So remember, what are the reserves? Well, in principle, we don't know yet without looking at the central bank. But just from looking at this, the reserves could be either central bank notes, the actual currency in this community, because we're assuming it's a fiat currency, fractional reserve economy, held in the commercial bank's own vaults on the premises, or they could be demand deposits that the commercial banks hold with the central bank in this country. We'll see in a moment, it turns out, these commercial banks have all of their reserves sitting on deposit with the central bank. But you wouldn't know that just from looking at the top left. We'll find that out in a second when we look down at the central bank. Okay, so now we have enough information. If I tell you that these commercial banks are fully loaned up, we can figure out what the reserve ratio is. Because we can say, total demand deposits are what? $50 billion. Reserves are what? Oh, $10 billion. So if I tell you these banks are fully loaned up, then you can deduce, oh, the reserve ratio requirement must be 20% because $10 billion is 20% of $50 billion. Okay. Now look down here at the central bank. And again, this isn't a full balance sheet. Rothbard's not listing anything under assets. He just wants to show you over here equity and liabilities because he wants to show you how these things are going to change once the public decides it wants to hold more paper currency. Demand deposits to the, so these are all liabilities from the central bank's point of view. They're on the right-hand side and they're under liabilities. Demand deposits to the bank is $10 billion. So now we know, the 10 billion up here and this 10 billion right there means that the commercial banks don't hold any currency in their own vaults in this very simplistic example. So let me just make sure you get that. If down here, this demand deposits owed to the bank had only been 7 billion, let's say, then it would have to be, then we would know that this number up here, the reserves, must be including 3 billion in currency in their vaults. Now, I think the way Rothbard is defining these terms, he would have listed the reserves at 7 billion and he would have said cash in the vault at 3 billion. Because just to be more specific. So I think in the way Rothbard discusses this in his text, he's going to say something like, the 10 billion up here has to equal the 10 billion down here, just as a matter of accounting. But I'm saying, don't be confused by that. He means, if that's true, then that means this term reserves means reserves held on deposit with the central bank. Because you could have reserves that are cash in your own vault. And then this 10 billion and this 10 billion could be different numbers. Okay, so is that clear to everyone? Make sure that makes sense to you. Why, if the commercial banks think they have money on deposit with the central bank, then from the central bank's perspective on its balance sheet, that number is a liability. Because it's saying, for example, Citibank has $1 billion on deposit with us, the central bank. So I'm the central bank, that's a liability to me. It's just like if Joe Smith has a deposit of $1,000 with Citibank, from Citibank's perspective, that $1,000 is a liability because Joe Smith could show up and say, give me my money. By the same token, Citibank can go to the central bank and say, hey, we've got $1 billion in deposit with you, we want $180 million. So that's why the central bank on its books, in terms of standard accounting, treats those things as a liability. Now what's more interesting and less obvious is the central bank notes are also listed on a central bank's balance sheet as liabilities. So this is true. And the Fed will have this. If you go to the Fed's balance sheet, which we last week I showed you how to find it, you can flip through it and see one of its major line items is the total amount of U.S. currency outstanding. And so in this hypothetical example, it's $15 billion. So this $15 billion right here doesn't point to anything else on this slide. That's just a new number that he's writing there. So what that means is, you know, the public in this scenario, what's the total amount of money that the public holds? So what would be M1, for example? Well, it's the demand deposits, this number $50 billion up here, plus $15 billion in currency. Because we already know that all the currency is held by the public. There's not a single dollar in paper currency there that's in the vaults of the commercial banks. So the total amount, so total money stock equals 50 plus 15 equals $65 billion, right? Because the public's holding $15 billion in currency plus the $50 billion they have on deposit with all the commercial banks collectively. So that's $65 billion total that the public believes is money in its possession. Incidentally, I think Rothbard made a lot of his decisions just to keep stuff simple. So he didn't have the commercial banks have any currency in the vault just to keep things simple so you don't have to keep track of all this stuff. But it's easier to imagine the public holds all the currency so that the commercial bank's reserves consist entirely of demand deposits with the central bank. All right, so in practice, things aren't going to be like that. Some of the paper currency is going to be in the vaults of the commercial bank and some is going to be in the wallets and purses of the general public. Well, Rothbard wants to keep things really simple. So all the currency is held by the public. Not a shred of it is in the vaults of the commercial banks. Okay, last thing before we move on from this slide, why is the $15 billion in currency that the public holds, why is that a liability to the central bank? Well, it's actually a historical anachronism that really, it's not a liability. If somebody goes up to the central bank and says, here's $10 in this note, what do I get? They're going to say, well, I can give you 2 fives or I can give you 10 singles. So from the central bank's point of view, the fact that there's all these notes floating around isn't a liability in any meaningful sense of that term, the way liability means something to any other business, even to a commercial bank. What does it mean to say that the $50 billion up here in demand deposits held by its customers is a liability? Well, it means because they can show up and say, give me my money. And then if they show up and say, hey, my ATM card says that I have $100 on deposit with you, Citibank can't simply say, yeah, so do you want to have two ATM accounts, one saying 50 and one saying 50? No, you could say, no, I don't want that. Give me a $100 bill, a Federal Reserve note. And Citibank can't just create that out of thin air. If they don't have it in the vault, and if they don't have it on deposit with the central bank, they're in trouble. But in a fiat money world, these outstanding banknotes, central banknotes, mean nothing. Historically, they did mean something. Historically, they were a genuine liability because they needed to have gold backing up or silver, right? So if the Fed pledged, as it did under the Bretton Woods system, that it would redeem U.S. dollars for gold at the rate of $35 per ounce, well then, yeah, the more of those green pieces of paper you got floating around the world, the bigger the liability to the Fed. It better have enough gold in its assets to, in case people show up and turn the dollars in for gold. But now that it's fiat money, it really isn't a liability, but yet, in terms of the accounting, we still treat it as such. Okay, kind of eating up a lot of time here, so I got to speed up here. Okay, next step, what happens? So step one, so that initially was the initial equilibrium. Now in step one, we're going to say, for some reason, the public wants to hold more currency and less in terms of bank deposits. Right, so from the public, from the individual household's point of view, he or she is not changing the total amount of money the household owns. It's just changing the composition of it. It's withdrawing some of the money from the bank to have a higher cash balance in terms of physical currency on hand. So what happens? So here, we're just showing changes. We're not showing the new state of the balance sheet. We're just showing how the previous slide, how the totals move. So the demand deposits go down by $2 billion because, right, so from the commercial bank's point of view, now its customers have $2 billion less. So what was the original amount? The original amount was $50 billion on deposit. Now its customers, in this initial, you know, the hour after this withdrawal spree, now its customers collectively only have $48 billion on deposit with them. So its liabilities have gone down by $2 billion in that category. And what happened, remember, they don't have any currency on hand. There's no currency in commercial banks' vaults, so what did they have to do? They had to call up the central bank and say, hey, we got to withdraw $2 billion of our reserves from you because we have to give currency to some of our customers. So the central bank says, okay. They fire up the printing presses, print up $2 billion, ship it to the commercial banks, and then the commercial banks hand it over to their customers. So this is unrealistic. In day-to-day operations, obviously, the commercial banks have some currency on hand, so they don't have to wait for the Fed to print it up. But, again, Rofford wants to keep things simple, and so that's why he's assuming it works this way. All right, so the commercial banks then, their reserves with the central bank go down by $2 billion because they had to draw down $2 billion of their reserves. So before that was, what, $10 billion? So now it's an hour after this stuff happens, it's down to $8 billion. So from the commercial bank's point of view, the balance sheets are all still fine, that its assets went down by $2 billion and its liabilities went down by $2 billion, so it's a wash. From the central bank's point of view, it's also a wash. What happened? Demand deposits with commercial banks dropped by $2 billion, so now the central bank owes the commercial banks $2 billion less, but that's offset by the fact that now there's $2 billion more in currency floating around. And so if you're going to treat that as a liability, which economically doesn't make much sense, but in terms of the accounting makes sense, it's just a wash also. So if this were a 100% reserve system and we initially had a 100% reserves, none of this would matter. It would just boom, boom, boom. The commercial banks would just change some of their numbers. The central bank would change some of their numbers. And then that would be it. The total money supply wouldn't have been affected or anything like that. And it, as of this moment, right after the change, the money supply also isn't affected because demand deposits are down. So what's the new situation? So total money now is what? It's 48 plus 17. Which is still 65, right? Because the public now only has $48 billion on the deposit with the banks, and it's holding $17 billion in paper currency. So the total quantity of money is still $65 billion, and it looks like that's it. But the problem is now the banks have deficient reserves. So instead of having excess reserves, now they're actually they have less than sufficient ones. So they have negative excess reserves. That's the way you want to describe it. Because what they're holding now, let me go back here. So remember here, this is really a messy slide at this point, they had $10 billion in reserves backing up $50 billion in demand deposits. And that satisfied the 20% requirement. But now what do they have? They only have $8 billion in reserves, backing up $48 billion in total demand deposits. So, but $8 billion is only 20% of $40 billion. See what I'm saying? So $8 billion in reserves can only support $40 billion in demand deposits, because $8 billion is 20% of $40. So since they have $48 billion in demand deposits, they have deficient reserves, and right now they're breaking the law. So what do they have to do? The commercial banks do not have the power to increase reserves. Only the central bank can do that by buying assets. So what do they have to do? They have to get their demand deposits down by $8 billion. How do they do that? They call in loans. Or when someone pays off a loan, they don't re-extend it to somebody else. And so through that mechanism, their IOUs shrink because now fewer people in the community owe the banks money, but their liabilities also shrink. So this part of what I'm talking about is what I walked through in that long lecture, I think week two, about the mechanics of fractional reserve banking. So if you're a little bit fuzzy on that, you don't understand how could commercial banks, by having people pay off previous loans and then not issuing new loans, why would that help with this problem I'm talking about here? I don't have time tonight to go over that again, but that was in the earlier lecture I gave where I showed, in terms of the accounting, how is it that banks, by extending loans, can increase both their liabilities and their assets and increase the total quantity of money. If you get how that works, then you can see how the opposite works. The banks, when people pay off loans, that shrinks their balance sheets, the assets and the liability side. And then if the banks just sit tight, that has helped solve the problem. Somebody in the question or the comments is worrying, saying, how can a bank call in a loan? Seems like a basic violation of typical contract terms. Okay, so there's a couple things. So one thing is if you have like a bank line of credit and you owe the bank $5,000, let's say originally they gave you a $10,000 line of credit and you were using five of it in your business, and you get high cash flow coming in, you pay it down, but then you have a period where your cash flow is not coming in, so your bank line of credit starts getting higher and higher. The amount you're using gets higher and higher, but you're always well within the $10,000 limit they gave you initially when they first ran a credit check and approved you. The fine print of that contract, the bank can come along probably at any point and say, we're calling this in. I mean, they might not say you can have to pay up tomorrow, but they might be able to say you have 30 days to pay us the $5,500 that you currently owe us. Or we're cutting you down, instead of having a $10,000 credit limit, we're going to scale you back to only having a $2,000 credit limit. Since right now you owe us $5,500, you have 30 days to pay us $3,500 to get your outstanding balance down to $2,000. Right? So it's not necessarily they can do it instantly, but they can certainly scale you back fairly quickly. The other thing is, at any given time, on any day, a major bank is going to have some people paying off loans, right? So even if someone took out a six-month loan, well, at any given day, somebody's loan will be 6 months old as of that day, and so they're going to be paying it off, and then the bank normally would just roll it over and lend it out to somebody else, but they're going to stop doing that. And so that's what I'm saying. Now, I see some other people, too, saying banks can sell loans. They can, but then that's not going to shrink loans in the total system. So, yeah, one bank, if one bank is deficient and has negative excess reserves, but some other bank has positive excess reserves, then, yeah, the banks can just transfer stuff among each other and be fine. But if the whole banking system as a whole, collectively, has deposits that are higher than the reserves they need, then collectively they have to shrink the outstanding loan values. And so just one bank selling loans off of its books isn't going to help if some other bank buys the loan. I guess a non-bank person could do it. Okay, let's keep moving. So now what happens? In the new equilibrium, when the banks have contracted their outstanding loan volume, what happens? You see, they did just what I said. Their IOUs have now dropped to $32 billion, when originally they were $40 billion. And their reserves are now $8 billion, and so total assets have dropped to $40 billion, and demand deposits have dropped to $40 billion. And so now they're once again satisfying their reserve ratio. They have $8 billion in reserves backing up $40 billion total in demand deposits. So that's a 20% reserve ratio. This $8 billion here corresponds with that $8 billion. And the central bank notes are $17 billion. So now what's happened to the total money supply? It's $40 billion in demand deposits plus $17 billion held by the public is only $57 billion. And remember, originally it was $65 billion. So what happened is $8 billion somehow magically disappeared from the economy. And that's not a coincidence, or I can point to you exactly how we knew it had to be that number, because the public is holding $2 billion more in cash than it was before. So that's $2 billion that used to be in the commercial banking system that's now been pulled out. And in this example, or in this scenario, there's a 20% reserve requirement. So because of the 20% thing, that means there's an ability of the bank to multiply five times on top of something. Right? So by putting the $2 billion into the commercial banks in terms of their reserves, they can now issue $10 billion more in demand deposits. So that difference between two going in and then now 10 being supported, that difference of eight is what's happening. All right, so what did this example show? It showed that when the community here wanted to withdraw $2 billion to hold as cash that previously had been in the commercial banking system, the total quantity of money shrank by $8 billion. So what's the relevance to the Great Depression? Exactly what we just talked about happened from 1929 to 1933, that there were massive runs on the banks for various reasons. People in general were fearful, so they started taking their money out. Banks, many banks were seen to have made bad investments during the bubble in the late 20s, and so rumors would start circulating, oh man, our bank's not solvent, so people would rush to get their money out before the bank collapsed. So for various reasons, the public withdrew a lot of money from the commercial banking system. And because of this, what we just walked through, commercial fractional reserve banking, the public, just by changing the composition of its individual cash holdings, in terms of do we want it physically in cash in our pockets or do we want to have some of it on deposit with commercial banks, the public put extreme downward pressure on the total money supply. So measures like M1 and M2 dropped by about one-third from 1929 to 1933. So just be careful when you, and that's what Milton Friedman and his co-author Anna Schwartz, that was their huge contribution in their work when they looked, they did like a monetary history of the United States, and that was one of their big contributions. They changed the conventional academic understanding of what happened during the Great Depression. And Friedman and Schwartz convinced a lot of economists that the Fed didn't inflate enough. So it wasn't, just be careful about this, it was not that the Fed consciously sought to destroy money. Rather, what Friedman is blaming the Fed for is that the Fed sat back and was too timid and didn't act enough to offset the public's action. So the monetary base did not go way down during the early 30s. You can go to Fred and look at it. But what happened is because the public was withdrawing so much from the banks, the monetary base would have needed to go way up to offset that. And because both of the gold standard and just the conservatism of the people running the Fed, they didn't inflate the monetary base enough to offset what the public was doing. And so that's why M1, M2, things like that fell sharply. So that's why, if you remember, early on in today's lecture, I showed you M1 has gone up substantially since 2008. So whatever else you want to say about what Bernanke has been doing, he has not committed the same mistake as the Fed in the early 30s. The total quantity of money, conventionally measured, is much higher now than it was in 2008. So Bernanke has not stood by and done too little as the public increases its demand to hold currency. So what the modern defenders or modern expositors of what's called market monetarism now say is, they're saying, well, yeah, it's true, but in terms of the public's demand to hold money, Bernanke still hasn't done enough. So yeah, the total quantity of M1 has gone way up, but still the demand to hold money in general has gone up so much that it's effectively tightening things, and that's why Bernanke should be doing more. Dan Lynn says, can you quickly use the Rofford balance sheets to identify the difference between money supply and quantity of money? No, I can't, because money supply would mean list various hypothetical purchasing powers of money, and then what's the corresponding amount of money that producers of money want to provide, right? So what's the supply of apples? It's a line that's upward sloping, and the y-axis is saying what's the hypothetical price of apples per pound, and then the x-axis is how many apples do producers want to bring to market at those various hypothetical prices. So we talk about what's the supply of money, that doesn't even really make much sense if you're talking about a central bank. If you're talking about a totally laissez-faire community where there's miners who mine gold, and then they bring certain amounts of gold to the surface based on gold's purchasing power. That makes sense. We could draw a supply curve of money in that kind of framework, but it's kind of weird to say what the supply curve of money would be if it's a fiat currency controlled by a central bank. I mean, you could do it, but it would be kind of economically unmeaningful. Okay, Fed can change reserves. Let me just run through some of this stuff. So clearly at this point, I'm not going to have time to get to your questions, but if you guys do have questions, go ahead and post them and I'll capture it and then catch up with you. Since I'm back in town, I'll get caught up. It was hard. I was at Mises U last week, so I think I still have some pending questions from last Monday's lecture. Okay, discount versus the Fed funds rate. It's not terribly important, but if you really do want to get into the details of this stuff, you should know these distinctions. Okay, when the Fed loans directly to banks, that's done through the discount window, and the interest rate on that is the discount rate. Okay, so the Federal Reserve is capable of creating money out of thin air and lending it directly to a bank. And that's what the discount rate is. Historically, banks don't like to do that. Commercial banks do not want to have to go to the Fed and borrow from the discount window because there's a stigma attached to it. It looks like, hey, something must be wrong with that commercial bank. How come they can't get loans in the general market? Why do they need to go to the Fed? And so historically, commercial banks don't want to do that. Typically, and again, remember, all the stuff I'm saying is pertinent to conventional Fed operations. This is all before the crisis set in. Since the crisis set in, banks have had no problem going to the Fed and getting tons of money, as we'll see next week. But historically, you know, from whatever, 1970 onward, let's say, up until 2007, banks would not have, that's not the normal way banks would get more reserves. All right. So what happens more typically is that the various commercial banks in their day-to-day operations, some of them would have good investment opportunities, right? So they would grant loans, and then they would realize, oh, wait a minute, we're right now deficient. We have more outstanding demand deposits for our customers given the reserve requirement that we have reserves on deposit or with the Fed. So we're deficient. At the same time, there's some other bank out there that has an excess reserves. So the bank with the excess reserves, not the Fed, a regular commercial bank like Citibank realizes it has $2 billion in excess reserves, and HSBC realizes it's short $2 billion in reserves. So HSBC says to Citibank, we got to meet our statutory requirement, or I don't know if it's statutory, we got to meet the Fed's policy. We got to borrow $2 billion a year reserves. And they're overnight non-collateralized loans. And so that's conducted in the federal funds market, which is sort of misleading because it doesn't involve the federal government. And the interest rate at which that loan is effected is the Fed funds rate. So now what happens in practice, or at least up until mid-2008, the Fed would target the federal funds rate. But the way it would try to move it would be by affecting the total amount of reserves in the system. And it would do that through open market operations, which are buying and selling assets. All right, so if the Fed wants the federal funds rate to go down, so it wants commercial banks to be willing to lend each other reserves overnight at a lower interest rate, the Fed would buy assets because that puts more total reserves in the system. So now there's more banks that have excess reserves. They got to lend them out to somebody. They're willing to accept a lower interest rate. And vice versa, if the Fed wants the Fed funds rate to go up, they sell assets off the Fed's book that sucks reserves out of the system. So now the commercial banks are scrambling to individually meet the reserve requirements with a smaller amount of total reserves. And so the available excess reserves are going to get scarcer, so their price will go up. Okay, now let me just flip ahead and see how much more I got here. Okay. I will stop by 5 minutes after. Because we can go through this pretty quickly. Because my clock is showing that it's time to stop, but if you just give me 5 more minutes, I'll round out this discussion. Okay, so Rothbard's example, this is figure 10.9. What he's showing is the Federal Reserve wants to increase the amount of reserves in the system because it wants to push down the federal funds rate. So how does it actually do it? It could, if it wanted to, just through the discount window, lend money directly to the commercial banks. But I've explained why, for various reasons, typically that's not what they would do. In practice, what they would often do is they would go and they would buy $1 million worth of assets, like government bonds, let's say. And so Jones and Company was originally holding $1 million in government bonds. So the Federal Reserve Bank goes to Jones and Company and writes them a check for $1 million, says, here you go, and then takes their government bond. So now the Federal Reserve on its assets sheet, left side of its balance sheet, is holding $1 million more of government bonds. And Jones and Company now has a check written on the Fed. So what does Jones and Company do with it? They go to their bank, which happens to be Citibank, and deposit it. So now what happens? So from Citibank's point of view, their liabilities are up by $1 million because now whatever Jones and Company's checking account balance was an hour ago, now after they deposit the check from the Fed, that number is $1 million higher. So from Citibank's point of view, it owes its customers $1 million more. But on the plus side, its reserves are $1 million higher because Citibank in turn takes that $1 million check written on the Fed and hands it over to the Fed and says, now you owe us $1 million more. And so on the Fed balance sheet, on its liability side, the demand deposit to the banks has gone up by $1 million. In particular, on its books, the Fed now thinks that Citibank's deposits with it are $1 million higher than they were an hour ago. But the Fed also, its assets have gone up by $1 million in U.S. government securities. Okay, so if we had a 100% reserve system, that would be the end of the story. That would be it. But now Citibank has excess reserves. If it were fully loaned up before, now look what happened. It's got $1 million more in reserves, but only $1 million more in demand deposits. And so now if there's a 20% reserve requirement, it can afford to expand its demand deposits by 800,000. All right, and then that would set off multiple rounds of credit expansion by the banks. Okay, what am I doing in this slide? I want to show you historically, because the theory is that when the Fed wants to lower the federal funds rate, it buys assets and thereby increases reserves and the monetary base, because reserves are one of the components of the monetary base. So what I wanted to do was just ask, does that actually pan out empirically? Does that make sense? And this chart shows that, yeah, it is a pretty good story. So the blue line is the monetary base, and it's the left axis. But look, it's the percent change from a year ago. So it's not showing you the level of the monetary base. It's showing you the percentage change from 12 months prior, whereas the red line is the effective federal funds rate, and that's on the right. And you can see that's just the level, the percent. So The word affected there means it's not the target. It's what actually the banks literally in the market, if you go look at the market prices, what are the banks in practice charging each other on these overnight loans of reserves. So you can see, generally speaking, these things are mirror images of each other. So look over here. So this red line is the federal funds rate. So remember when they brought it way down, and why would they do that? Because look, there's a recession. That's what that gray bar is. So during this recession in the mid-50s or late 50s, they brought the federal funds thing way down, and then they started jacking it up. And you can see the increase in the growth of the monetary base went up, and then it slowed down. And then it went way up again, and that's when they brought it down again for this recession. And you see, like here, it's pretty clear, when they jacked up the federal funds rate, the growth rate in the monetary base came down. And then vice versa, the growth rates shot up again when the rate went down. And then you can really see a nice example here. Greenspan brings it way down, and you see a big burst in the growth rate, and then the growth rate tapers off as Greenspan is slowly jacking up the federal funds rate. Right? So again, it's not perfect, but generally speaking, they move in opposite directions, which is what you'd want to see for our story to make sense. Okay, in the real world, I'm not going to bother reading this thing about the New York Fed. That's just telling you how they do it in practice. And you can go see the primary dealers at that particular website if you're curious. A lot of people want to know who out there, you know, what are the actual groups in practice that deal with the Federal Reserve, that when the Fed wants to buy assets, it can't just go up to Joe Smith and write him a check for $1 million. The Fed goes through so-called primary dealers, and they're the ones that do the bulk of the business with the Fed. And so that's, if you're curious as to who these people are in real life, you go to that list. Okay, heretical ideas. Very quickly, let me just mention this, and then I'll have to stop. Some of you may actually have lives and have something you have to do. If you start looking around the internet, you're going to see a lot of people saying that the story I just told you and the story Rothbard spells out in his book, and this isn't just an Austrian thing, that in general, the conventional mainstream understanding of open market operations and how the central bank buys assets, increases reserves, now there's excess reserves, so the commercial banks want to lend them out so the interest rate goes down, and that's the way the central bank indirectly influences interest rates. That's not just an Austrian story. Everything Rothbard says in his book and everything I just said tonight is pretty orthodox stuff. I mean, we have little digs where we say this is inflation and robs people and that kind of stuff, but in terms of the mechanics and the accounting, that's not Austrian economics. That's just standard money and banking that you would learn anywhere from a professional economist. So there's a lot of people saying that's all bogus, that these idiot ivory tower economists have no clue about how banks work in the real world. And they'll say, in particular, banks do not have a reserve requirement. That just in practice they don't. And then a bank, the loan officer, you know, when they're looking at people applying for loans and things like that, they don't care what their reserve requirements are. They don't worry about, oh, do we have sufficient reserve? They decide on the merits, is this a good loan or not? And that's the way they play it out. Now, Doug French, the former president of the Mises Institute, who used to be an investment banker, he has told me personally, I've asked him, and he said, well, I'm not sure how to explain it, but it's for sure it's true. He said, I was never in a meeting where anybody ever said, hey, how are we looking in terms of our reserve requirement? And he said, if someone did ask that, nobody in the room would have known. They wouldn't even know what the guy was talking about. All right, so there is that element of truth to the critique. I think the explanation is, or what it could be, is that the higher ups of the banks, when they are looking at those types of things, and then they communicate their intentions to their subordinates, you know, they might say, hey, we want to tighten up our lending standards. And so the subordinates don't need to know why. They don't need to know if it's because the higher ups see a storm coming and they want to just tighten up, or it's because they're looking at the numbers and realize, oh, we're short on reserves. But clearly, there is an interbank market for reserves. Banks do lend each other reserves at positive interest rates. So it can't be the critique in its strong form that says this is completely garbage, there's no such thing as a reserve requirement. That can't be right. Otherwise, why are banks lending each other reserves? But it is true that in the real world, things are more complicated and nuanced than these simple stories we're telling. One last thing. It's also true that if, depending on what the Fed's policy is, it's possible that in many respects the public could indirectly influence the amount of reserves. So that if the public started drawing out, for example, suppose the Fed says we just want to keep the federal funds rate at 3%, and now the public starts drawing money out of the banks to increase their holdings, well, then that's going to put pressure on the banks, and now the price of overnight loans and reserves is going to go up for the reasons we talked about, that all of a sudden all the banks are going to find they're deficient in reserves. So they're not going to want to lend those reserves out to other banks, and the amount they'd be willing to pay to get reserves is going to go way up. So all of a sudden the federal funds rate might shoot up to 10%. So if the Fed sees that, whoa, we wanted our target was 3%, quick, go buy more assets to flood the market with reserves to get that Fed funds rate back down to our target. If that's the way things operate in practice, then the public can indirectly affect the amount of reserves, right? But just keep in mind, strictly speaking, the public can't directly change what the monetary base is, but they can indirectly do it if the Fed's policy is couched not in terms of total reserves, but instead in terms of a target for the federal funds rate or something like that. The public, through its actions, can make that thing move, and then the Fed might respond accordingly. So some of the critics mean something like what I just said. So they're going to say it's kind of misleading when you give conventional textbook explanations, making it look like the banks – it makes it look like the Fed is the exogenous mover and just decides on its own, I think I'm going to buy assets, and then – oh, now there's a bunch of excess reserves, and the banks say, oh, holy cow, excess reserves. Well, let's loan some more money out, when it's possible in practice it's the other way around, that the banks might see a bunch of good investment opportunities, make a bunch of loans, or the public might withdraw money, and now all of a sudden, oh, the banks are short on required reserves, and so the price goes up, and then the Fed responds by buying assets and supplying more. Okay, so the mechanism is still the same, but it's possible in practice the causality actually goes the other way around, that maybe the banks decide how much they're going to lend, and then that could affect the Fed funds rate, and then if the Fed doesn't want that Fed funds rate to be that, they offset it by doing open market operations. Okay, I got to stop there, guys. Thanks for tuning in, and be sure to take the quiz if you're taking the class for credit, and I'll see you guys next week.